Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's Sunday, August 13th,
right. 2017. You got it. Correct.
And here we go again.
Here we go again.
And where do you want to start?
Well, this week marked the passing of the great Barbara Cook.
Yeah, I don't really understand why I didn't see all that much fuss about.
Well, first of all, we should be clear to everyone who Barbara Cook is. Well,
right,
Barbara Cook being a one of the premier Broadway performers, singers on the stage, cabaret, Carnegie Hall concerts, but it all starts in the mid-1950s as the star of The Music Man, or the female lead of The Music Man opposite Robert Preston, the original, as one obituary put it, Marion the Librarian. But the story of Barbara Cook is what's interesting.
One.
It is, because she starts as this ingenue, the standard young Broadway ingenue, wide-eyed, beautiful, glittering, singing voice, and in fact, featured in Candide by Bernstein. And
a real showcase for her soprano.
Glitter and Be Gay, which she sang, very hard to sing, and not only did she sing it the way Bernstein wrote it, but she sang it and added an upper octave range, the very bit to give her signature to it, to make it that much more impossible for people to sing it in the future. A beautiful voice. But what happened with Barbara Cook was she reached a certain point in her life where she suffered from depression, she suffered from alcoholism, she gained a lot of weight, she withdrew from the stage, she divorced, she lost custody of her son, and she was at a low point. And at that point, with the help of a musical accompanist named Wally Harper and others, I'm sure, she resurrected a career, not as the ingenue in Broadway musicals, but as a cabaret performer and a concert performer who had a much broader emotional range.
Right. I guess what I don't get is Glen Campbell also passed away.
Right.
And, you know, there were big retrospectives about his career on every possible media. I saw very little mention of Barbara Cook, and I think of her as quite the luminary.
Yeah, there's no question she's a luminary. I think what you're seeing there is the difference between what I'll call the New York showbiz theater scene and the national scene, and it goes for music beyond just the Broadway / Hollywood.
Barbara Cook was also cabaret versus TV.
Exactly. And Barbara Cook, even in the musical roles that she was in, she didn't get the Broadway, she didn't get the Hollywood parts. I mean, when they did Music Man in Hollywood, they had Shirley Jones. They had somebody younger and thinner to do the part. I mean, she was centered in New York. So I agree with you. I would have expected more coverage, but I can sort of understand it. She may have been less of a national figure than a New York figure, at least in some degree, unless you're in theater circles. I will say this. The New York Times wrote two very, very interesting and I thought illuminating pieces about her. And there were, to the extent there were pieces about her in the New York media, the New York Times had the best possible coverage, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there were two points that come out of me at the Times. I know you had your own observations about favorite songs of hers. But what they did say, they focused on the 1985 concert performance of Follies. And and the way they set it up, which I think is probably fair, they have a clear-eyed view of the situation. You know, everyone accepts Sondheim as the great master today, but Sondheim at that point clearly was, you know, an established figure, but was not, there's a lot of ambivalence about Sondheim. Wasn't considered by everyone to be great. And Follies was not considered a great musical by any means, and it had not done well at the box office. And this concert performance was to sort of try it out again to see if you can get an audience for something that hadn't really succeeded.
And also, and Barbara Cook at that point is not a Sondheim fan.
No, not a Sondheim fan, and she's been doing, you know, dinner theater performances, trying to get her career going over the last 10 years. She's on the road back. Both she's starting to walk down that road. And that's a concert performance that includes a lot of very big names. You know, it had Barbara Cook, it had Lee Remick, it had Mandy Patinkin, it had Carol Burnett, if you recall. And it was a fantastically successful concert performance at a time when that was a new idea. And the centerpiece of it in Follies happened to be where there's a song that's called Buddy's Blues. And the character played by Mandy Patinkin is a guy who sings this song about being in love with two different women or being attracted to two different women. And the style of that show, Follies, is to have characters express themselves in vaudeville-type performance numbers. And he does this tour de force in which he plays several different characters. He's sort of a Broadway clown. And it's going over the conflict he feels about these two women. And it's comic and it's everything. And the crowd goes crazy at the end of it. And following it, they sort of switch the stage right. And they put the spotlight on Barbara Cook, who's playing one of the women that he is deciding that maybe he likes, maybe he doesn't like. And she sings a song called Losing My Mind. And I'll just to quote the way that song ends to give you a sense of it. It's a much quieter song, much centered song. She says, I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you love me, or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my mind? And the place goes crazy. And it's not just a triumphant performance in a sense that she sort of trumps Mandy Patinkin, but the point is the character trumps the other character in a way the show needs. The show pivots on that. He makes a point about how childish Patinkin is, how her situation, by contrast, how the characters have to deal with each other, and it sort of makes the show work better. And following that, I'm oversimplifying, but following that, Follies is recognized as a great show and gets a full production. Sondheim's career continues to rise. Barbara Cook's career continues to rise. And she sings Sondheim songs.
Yes, she begins to interpret a lot of
songs. And you had another song in mind.
Well, no. Well, what I wanted to say is I never really liked Barbara Cook.
Okay.
And in fact, you may remember, I remember one time, it was probably close to 20 years ago. And I'm cooking. You're putting on some cooking music for me, and you put on Barbara Cook, and I just scream. I say anything but Barbara Cook. I was not on team Barbara Cook.
Right.
And I wasn't on team Sondheim either.
Right. That's for sure. Right.
I didn't really resonate with me, right. And I have to say that as time went by.
Yeah.
I find Sondheim, Barbara Cook's interpretations of Sondheim and other songs just more poignant than any other interpretations. And I really, I'm amazed by Sondheim's, the way Sondheim captures people and relationships and is able to articulate that. And so... one of my favorite songs that Barbara Cook sang by Sondheim is actually Not a Day Goes By. And let me just read a few words from that. Not a day goes by, not a single day, but you're somewhere a part of my life, and it looks like you'll stay. As the days go by, I keep thinking, where does it end? Where's the day I'll have started forgetting, but I just go on thinking and sweating and cursing and crying and turning and reaching and waking and dying. And that's from Merrily
We Roll Along, yeah.
Which we saw not that long ago, which we thought was great.
Which is an obscure Sondheim show, but also a great show. Look, we'll just close on Barbara Cook with the way they close it in the Times, which I thought was actually very fitting. It's an article by Steve Holden, who does a lot of their reviews. And he talks about seeing Barbara Cook at an all-star Carnegie Hall event, and she sang a song of the type that Tams and I were just talking about and brought the auditorium, I'm reading now, to a hushed silence. James Taylor, the next singer to perform, offered the perfect comment. Briefly turning his head to gaze off stage, he said, there's only one, Barbara Cook.
Exactly. All right, so... I've been threatening to go to some exhibitions in New York, the Henry James exhibition at the Morgan, the Rauschenberg at MoMA, and I actually did truck in to the city last week and went to the Morgan. Wow, the Morgan is just a great little museum. Mm-hmm. It's just a great little museum, and it's an extravagance. Well, I think it's expensive. You pay $25 to get in.
Okay.
And it's not huge. It's not like you're spending, you know, 5 or 6 hours there. But it is, again, free on Friday nights between 7 and 9. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to dart in, that's a great time to do it. And, you know, it's a beautiful place. The Henry James exhibition was very interesting to me. I loved it. I loved going in Morgan's library and seeing other, you know, various treasures from his collection. That was fun. There was also an exhibition about Henry David Thoreau and his writings, his journals, even his, you know, going to Harvard. And there was his desk there. And so that was fun as well. And Rauschenberg at MoMA, and MoMA was teeming with activity. I went on a Thursday night.
Right.
They're about to have a concert out into the Sculpture Garden.
It was a warm day, too.
It was just full of life, full of fun, which is what you have to say about Rauschenberg's work. And I didn't have nearly enough time to spend there, so maybe I'll go back before it closes. But that's really an engaging, sociable, interesting artists, and his work is kind of fun too. It's not even, you know, my thing, but I think Rauschenberg draws you in.
Okay. I mean, you were there because I dragged you there so we could go see a play afterwards.
No. I said I'm going to these exhibitions.
Well, whatever. It was a tie.
And you tricked me into going to a play.
I tricked you.
Yes.
I tricked you.
You also tricked me into going out for dinner.
I'm incorrigible. There's no question about it.
Which we went to Becco.
Which is always nice.
Still Lydia Bastianich restaurant.
Right. If you get in, it's a wonderful pre-theater place.
Yeah. It just, the food's good. The service is above reproach.
Yeah.
And
it makes a difference.
Yeah. So anyway.
So to complete our Thursday evening, so then we saw Marvin's Room. So Marvin's Room is an interesting play, an interesting story.
Written about 1991,
right,
by Scott McPherson. And in the review for this production, they mentioned that it was the funniest and saddest play of the season.
Well, I don't know if it's ever this production. I think the story is this. To really drill down on
it. In the 1991.
The reviews in the 1991 production apparently were extremely positive. It was a big deal play, such a big deal play. It resulted in a movie that starred, which is startling. I'll just give you the cast. Diane Keaton, Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So this is kind of serious business, right?
Yeah.
And yet it hasn't been produced. It was off-Broadway, by the way, in 91. It wasn't on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
So now they do a Broadway production.
Roundabout.
Roundabout does it. And they do it some 25 years later or thereabouts. And how is it? It's
okay.
Fair.
Not the worst thing I've ever seen.
No, it's not. So, but it's not. Yeah, and the story is, I don't think you're giving away if you give away the story too much. The story is about two sisters, one sister in particular who's caring for the ailing father of the two sisters living in Florida.
And his sister.
And his sister, who's Dottie, who doesn't really get much. And the father is bedridden, right? And she's this
her
woman.
Her estranged sister.
Before that happened, her estranged sister ends up coming down because the woman who's the caregiver contracts leukemia, gets sick.
She's diagnosed with...
Right. And the story pivots around her being examined and getting diagnosed and the help that her sister is able to give her or not give her. And that's what the story becomes about, her plight. And what's interesting about this is that, and I should say, the sisters are played by Lily Taylor, who plays the main part of the sister who contracts leukemia, and Janine Garofalo, who plays the sister, who comes to visit her. And they're very good. They're extremely good. I can't imagine.
Well, I always love Garofalo.
Yeah.
And she's...
And I can't imagine Diane Keaton doing as well as Lily Taylor in that role. She doesn't seem suited to it, honestly. The soul suffering...
Well, you said she got nominated...
Doesn't mean that much
for
to me.
Oscar.
She did get nominated for an Oscar, but Lily Taylor was fantastic. Right. And yet, having said all that, the play's not that good. And why is that? Why is it that it registered so much in 1991 and doesn't today? And that's what I've been thinking about. And I do have a theory.
Okay, what's your theory?
My theory is this. It's not so much about the way it was produced, because this was a first-class production, and what the performers brought to it, because they're first-class also. It's what the audience brings to it. In 1991, what the audience brought to it, downtown in particular, was an extreme sensibility about AIDS. And you had Scott McPherson writing a play, which is produced at the time, that his lover is suffering from AIDS, soon to pass away, and McPherson, I think, passed away 6 months after that. And everyone's attuned to the story of this young woman who contracts this terrible disease, leukemia, and that adds a certain emotional heft to the play. The problem is the environment's changed now, and it's changed so much that Roundabout recognizes it, and it markets the play as something about the plight of the caregiver, Lily Taylor as caregiver. Yeah. For her ailing older father. And you can understand when you look out in the audience why they might want to do that.
Right.
Because the audience is filled with people who are giving that care or getting that care. Right. It's an older audience. The problem is the play's not about that.
Right. She seems actually fine.
Yeah. She's fine.
And leukemia notwithstanding.
Right.
Not like she seems to be.
To go in order, the Marvin Room is not about Marvin. It's not about the guy's alien. There's no actor who appears as Marvin. Number two, she's not suffering from being the caregiver. And she doesn't seem even overly concerned about how that care is going.
She seems pretty chipper.
Yes. So what the play is about is a young woman getting sick, which is fine. But, you know, as you know, showbiz goes, as plays goes, as movie goes, that's a very popular, common theme. And when you're sitting and you're watching a play like that, you're saying, well, why does this play stand out? And this play doesn't particularly stand out.
Well, but I wouldn't say it's about the caretaker getting sick.
Okay.
I think it's about these family relationships.
Okay, that's fair enough. And I thought it was okay. I thought it was good, but it was not nearly the pedigree that you expected. And frankly, the reviews reflected that.
The pedigree?
Yeah. If you have a play that attracts in the movie Diane Keaton, Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, it's a serious deal. It's a serious piece of material.
All right.
But didn't play like that. And our final Broadway note, as long as we're staying on that, although it's not Thursday night. Well,
yeah,
about. It was Thursday night, possibly. Well, part of it was.
Back to Groundhog Day.
Back, Bill Murray.
One of the things that we chatted about en famille was, I wonder if Bill Murray has seen this.
Right.
The musical.
Right.
The Broadway musical, based on the movie that Bill Murray starred in. And, you know, we all mused about it. But lo and behold, this week in the paper was noted that Bill Murray and his brother actually did go to see the play.
Right.
And he was seen visibly sobbing at the end.
Yes.
And he did go backstage. And we've seen a picture of him with the actors, including our buddy, Barrett Doss,
who took us backstage just a week or two before. And they had a nice picture in the Times, but not as nice as the picture that appeared in Barrett's Instagram account, where she has the comment about the experience with Bill Murray. It just kept getting better. He told me some great secrets, and he loved the show. Come and see us. So, look, go see Groundhog Day. Apparently now the cast has gotten some great secrets from Bill Murray, so we'll be that much better, I guess. And what's also funny, too, is what he did.
Is a day later, he went again.
Because it's Groundhog Day.
He went Tuesday night.
Groundhog Day. He had to relive the experience.
Right. So, and once again, life is imitating art.
Yes.
So there you have it, Groundhog Day.
All right. So you saw an article about the Grossingers in the paper.
Yes, actually. Someone has applied to make it into some kind of resort. In order to do that, it needs remediation. Apparently, there have been all kinds of chemicals dumped there.
I can tell you as an environmental attorney, groundwater remediation is the toughest remediation to do.
And in order to do that, he needs it declared officially, whatever.
A brownfield.
Yes, a brownfield.
That's why you're married to a lawyer. I know this stuff.
Yeah, I knew there was a reason.
Yes.
And once it's declared as a brownfield, he can get state funds or federal funds?
He can get certain aid.
Anyway, so going back to what Grossinger's is, or was, it was a great resort in the Catskills.
Yes,
it was. And,
exactly
you know, one of the places that inspired that movie, Dirty Dancing.
Yes. And it was, it's in the Catskills, it's around Ellenville or thereabouts, or Liberty, New York.
The Borscht Belt.
That is it by definition, because it's, look, it's a largely, was a Jewish crowd, a Jewish resort. I guess I, the closest I've come, I went to Kutcher's in that area at some point, working at some camp. Same idea. They used to have a lot of entertainers. They called them tumblers. Guys like Danny Kaye started there.
And you go there with your whole family.
Right.
And, you know, perhaps hope to make some romantic connections.
Well, it's you know, maybe. There's a lot to do. You know. They had sports. They had a famous guy doing Simon Says.
It was a grand hotel.
Right. And they
and
showed
pictures.
And
we love a grand hotel.
We're all about grand hotels. They had a picture of a big swimming pool they had, which was very elegant in a certain kind of way. And they show that it's gone in disrepair since then. And they the article, they had someone observing what it was, what kept it going and why it doesn't work anymore economically as it was conceived. And they said the three A's. What changed are the three A's. Number one, airfare. People can fly someplace else on vacation. Don't have to go to groceries. Two, air conditioning. People don't have to go anywhere. If it's hot, they can stay in their apartment. And three, assimilation, which is the Jews at that point were keeping by to themselves. They needed a Jewish resort. And now,
well,
not
they
so much.
Often weren't welcome at other
they
places.
They weren't welcome at other places.
So it was large. It was a New York crowd.
Right.
But it's been closed since 1986. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And it's just, you can go online and see pictures of what it looks like now. And it's just in a very sad
they are miles,
state of disrepair.
They are miles from getting this thing open. And frankly, to me, it's a highly questionable enterprise. They closed the article with a quote from a guy, I think named Kellerman, in the movie. Who's talking about what the future of these resorts, and he says, I don't know, do you think that kids want to come up here with their parents and learn a foxtrot? That's what the resort Dirty Dancing was facing, and that's what Grossinger is facing to some degree. They'd have to reconceive it in some way. They'd have to be like Vegas. I mean, right. And they'd probably have to have gambling.
Well, you know, I should just mention that I first heard of Grossinger's as actually part of, there was an exhibition that my friend Nancy Ferguson was involved in, working on an exhibition on the Grand Resort Hotels at the Cooper Hewitt in New York. It was in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, we weren't so much about grand hotels.
Right.
I mean, motels were the thing, right? Mm-hmm. Being able to drive around, zip here and there. The idea of the grand hotel where you went and stayed for a long time because it was too hot to be in the city, et cetera, had really faded. So there was a certain charm and nostalgia to these hotels. It was a great exhibition, and it covered places. It didn't have Grossinger's in it, but what it did have, Grossinger's at a certain point had been kind of renovated and punched up a bit by a guy named Morris Lapidus, who will be really famous for the design of the great hotels, including the Fontainebleau down in Miami Beach, and creating that whole kind of aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And I will just say that one of the hotels that we were introduced to by that exhibition was Mohonk Mountain House.
Sure, which we love going to, but, you know, it's sort of the exception that proves the rule. When you're a Mohonk, when you see the lengths that they went to and the surroundings that they have, which are unique, you get a feeling how much goes into making this kind of enterprise successful. And that's why I say it's going to be a huge challenge for Grossinger.
And Mohonk still does seem successful, but they have reinvented themselves again and again. It's an amazing natural setting, but they've created a spa with the wonderful indoor pool in addition to the wonderful Mohonk.
And the skating rink and everything
else. So, it's a project, but
there's something worth looking into if you're looking into that kind of hotel. Mohonk now and look for Grossinger in the future.
Maybe. Or you can go to one of these spas for men that they mentioned in the Wall Street Journal.
Don't do that. I would not do that.
Dan is a little anti-spa experience for men.
Yeah, it's couldn't. Yes. So
because he already has great skin. Okay, he has that balanced diet.
The sports beat. Baseball. The article jumped out at me in terms of baseball. You know, there were two guys who passed away this week, Darren Dalton and Don Baylor. And what was interesting about Darren Dalton and Don Baylor...
Well, I asked you about Darren Dalton because there's a big fuss in the Philadelphia area.
Yeah. No. So Darren Dalton's
a typical guy. Who was he?
Yeah. So Darren Dalton was a guy who was a catcher on the Phillies team that went to the World Series against Colorado. Years ago, didn't quite make it in that World Series, but that's getting to the World Series was a very big deal. And he was, as I said to Tams at the time, very well known in Philly, kind of a local figure, local hero, great success, early 90s, and great leader, tough guy, great leader. And that's what really distinguished him. The cats are always takes a lot of bumps and bruises. He had bad knees, but he's a big, strong fellow. When he spoke, everyone in the locker room listened. He had a bunch of tough guys in that team. You had Lenny Dykstra, you had John Kruk, you had Curt Schilling. They were wild guys. And when they played Atlanta in the playoffs, it was America's team versus America's most wanted. I mean, he had, I mean, Dalton had gotten hurt and almost gotten killed at some time before that because he was in a car with Kruk and with Dykstra driving when Dykstra was drunk, which was the kind of thing Dykstra did. Dykstra is a crazy guy, still is a crazy guy. They were just a bunch of rough and ready guys, but he was a tough guy and credited with leading that team. And Baylor is a little bit of a parallel. Baylor bounced around on several teams, maybe at his best years with the Angels, played with the Yankees, played with the Athletics, but a very, very tough guy. And part of his toughness was he was willing to get hit by a pitch. He set a record for a hit by a pitch. He crowded the plate. He dared the pitchers to hit him. There's a story here about one time Burt Blyleven, a great pitcher in the Hall of Fame, threw a pitch that somehow ended up under Don Baylor's arm. Don Baylor calmly took it out, threw it back to Blyleven. Blyleven said he looked at it to see if there was a dent in the ball. and he was totally unafraid. Harold Reynolds on Baseball America was telling a story about he was in a big fight, a melee, in one of these games, and that Baylor's in the fight too on the other team, and he sees Reynolds jump in the pile. He takes Reynolds out, pulls him out with one hand, and he says, "You don't belong here, little man," and puts him aside. Two very tough guys. And that's the way the game was played. Those guys were leaders of the team. You see debates now about does team chemistry matter? Does leadership matter? These guys don't have the stats necessarily, but they were team leaders, very much respected in the cities where they were during these various pennant races. And you have inevitably the contrast. By coincidence, the same day of these articles, an article appears about the fact that Noah Syndergaard is appearing in Game of Thrones. Noah Syndergaard, Thor, 6'6", huge guy, strong guy, out for the season because he tore part of his lat muscle, certainly a legitimate injury, but not on the sidelines entirely, as we see a photo here with him in battle gear playing the part of a spear-throwing soldier in Game of Thrones.
And he does throw a spear.
He does throw a spear, so his lat can't be that bad. And then he is incinerated by a fire-breathing dragon. On Twitter, Syndergaard defended his role in the fight, saying it was a frickin' dragon. There's no question. Dragons are
to
tough.
To be honest, I would think Thor could actually beat a dragon.
I don't know what Thor can do in terms of dragons.
Thor can do a lot.
But, you know, it's a little bit of a contrast between succeeding in a Hollywood comic book way. Syndergaard's a young kid, we'll see. But the guys who make an imprint of the game, the guys like Dalton and Baylor who prove it on the field over the years, Syndergaard will have that chance later on. It's kind of an old-time baseball thing, but it was a reminder with these two passing this week.
All right, back to books. Okay.
Yeah.
So I should say that, you know, I made disparaging remarks about what she ate last week. But I will say on Fresh Air, the review by Maureen Corrigan, I think her name is, was very positive. So who knows?
I know. Who You're knows? Right. Maureen Corrigan's wrong.
Oh, all right. Okay. I should say the other book I'm reading lately that I just started is What a Fish Knows.
Oh, God.
By Jonathan Balcom.
That's right.
Because I had an interaction with some fish on vacation. And let me just say this.
Yeah.
Fish know a lot.
That's...
Okay.
That's...
It's kind of amazing. I'm not ready to talk about it, but it's a terrific book. So if you're interested in what fish know,
yeah,
try Balcom's book.
Yeah.
The review that caught my eye in the Wall Street Journal this week actually was One Hot Summer by Rosemary Ashton. And it's basically about the 1850s, or 1858 to be precise, in London, which was a very hot summer, and it was super smelly in London because of the Thames. The Thames, the river that goes through London, also happened to be their whole sewage system. Mm-hmm. And their system really involved just dumping sewage into the Thames. And when it got really hot, it was really, really awful. Actually, at that time, they didn't really understand a lot about bacteria and infections. Mm-hmm. And people actually thought the smell itself, the aroma itself, which is actually a symptom of the bacteria in the river, that they thought actually the aroma could make you sick, could give you cholera, etc.
Close enough, probably. Well,
but, I mean, so this book seems full of great stories about all the ruckus this stink caused in various aspects of London life, with all kinds of people, including celebrities such as Dickens, I should say, Disraeli, Darwin, etc. So it's quite fascinating. The great thing is that the new Houses of Parliament sat right on the Thames. And so the smell was right there wafting into the halls of Parliament, which galvanized the government into, you know, financing a solution. And the book does go into the sanitary reformers and imaginative engineers who came up with the solutions so that London could survive. At the end of the review says, in short, this book does not stink.
Oh, great.
Far from it.
That's high praise.
So that sounds like an interesting
book. Well, it's interesting that it was such a pervasive
by Rosemary Ashton.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact that so many people recognize it. There's this problem in London at that time. And it was such a part of London life. It's kind of remarkable. And they couldn't do anything about it. Or couldn't do anything for a while.
Well, they weren't bothering to do anything about it. You know, it just, I mean, it seems like a fairly normal bureaucratic thing. It's like, whatever.
Well, I guess at a certain point. Well, listen, there's an obituary here in the Times about a fellow named Ty Harden. And the reason that I'm going to talk about this just for a minute is this. First of all, why do we talk about obituaries? We talk about obituaries because they're interesting windows in the way people live their lives, in the way people generally live their lives 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And sometimes there are very interesting stories about the figures there. And there's a little bit of concern when you look at obituaries as to whether you're the Times, for example, is glorifying people, or whether there's a tendency to make things seem more positive than they otherwise are, because after all, the person's passed away and you're trying to be as respectful as possible.
Well, I do read most of these obituaries, I'm thinking, wow, they did this and this and this.
But the point is, notwithstanding, there's a suspicion that they're being as positive and respectful as possible. You can now put that thought completely out of your minds, because the Times has written an obituary about a fellow named Ty Harden, star of the Western called Bronco, dying at the age of 87. And Bronco was a television show that perhaps Tamsin will remember, this type of show, when there was a show called Sugarfoot, when there was a show called Cheyenne, when there was a show called The Rifleman. These were all television
Rifleman
shows
I remember, but
with Western themes. They weren't great, you know, drama, but they were kids / teenagers, those young people, television shows when things were a little less sophisticated. And Bronco was like a summer replacement, like Clint Walker turned his ankle, so they need someone to do some shows. And this guy caught some interest, and he's Bronco. He's a young guy with a cowboy hat and a pistol. They have a picture of him here. Okay, that's good as far as it goes. But the story in the obituary takes a turn after that. That's his high point, Ty Harden, star of Bronco. After Bronco had run its course, he appeared in several films. They were unsuccessful, the high point being Troy Donahue's vehicle Palm Springs Weekend, which was not much at all. He started doing horror films in Europe, and then spaghetti westerns, and then an Australia adventure series, kind of running out of gas. And then he made two decisions that kind of sabotaged his own career, the Times tells us. Number one, he turned down the lead role in A Fistful of Dollars, which is the film that rejuvenated Clint Eastwood's career. And then he followed that up by turning down the role of television's Batman, which, of course, made Adam West an iconic figure. So now he's not only his career has taken a turn, but he's sabotaging his own career. And then after returning to the United States In the 1970s, the Times reports, Mr. Hardin came into conflict with the Internal Revenue Service over non-payment of taxes. He then formed an anti-tax, anti-government protest group that evolved into the Arizona Patriots Militia Movement, which was accused in 1986 of planning to blow up an IRS complex in Utah, when in fact the feds invaded their headquarters. They confiscated weapons and publications from Aryan Nation groups. Now the Times really has poor Mr. Hardin on the ropes. And then in the last paragraph, the coup de grace delivered in the Times understated way, quote, Mr. Hardin's first seven marriages ended in divorce. So what possessed the New York Times to run this obituary just to beat this guy up? I haven't the slightest idea.
There's got to be a reason.
I only mention it because the Times it was now the focus of a documentary about how their obituary department works. I don't know how they justify this one, but there's something going on here.
Yeah.
It sort of makes you
unrelentingly negative.
Yeah, very strange. What we'll close with, they have one other very, I'm going to take a brief point from about an obituary of an umpire named Ken Kaiser, who passed away, who's sort of a cartoonist view of an umpire. Big, barrel-chested guy. He happened to be 300 pounds, who engaged in professional wrestling in the off-season. Very combative.
Mm-hmm.
They have a photo here of him screaming at Earl Weaver, giving each other what for. Illuminating because it gives you a sense of what it is the umpires and the players are saying when they are, you know, discussing a call that they have a different view about. They give the example of Eddie Murray, who played on Earl Weaver's team for the Orioles. He's a great player. He's in the Hall of Fame. But he wasn't much of a talker. And at one point, after being called out on strikes by Ken Kaiser, he turns to Ken Kaiser and he says, starts talking. And Kaiser says to him, Eddie, we haven't talked for 15 years. Why should we start now? That apparently is not enough for Murray. Who then challenges Kaiser to a fight. As the Times reports, Kaiser agreed, telling him, Eddie, you can even bring your bat with you because the way you're swinging this year, you couldn't hit me with it anyway. So for all that's wondering, that's what goes on during those discussions. The umpires are all dry wits, and the baseball players are negatively impressed, but that's why they're so combative. In any event, that's all we have this week.
At Tamsin and Dan, read the papers. See you next week.
Thanks.